Okay, well, yeah, I want to thank the organizers for the invitation and for putting together what looks to be an excellent meeting. And so what I want to do is talk about quantum error correction. And so what we mean by that is error correction in the context of quantum computing, quantum information. I'm going to try to say some general things, but I also want to get into some of the things I've been working on. So to do this, I'm going to have to tell some half-truths along the way, and hopefully you'll allow me that. And in particular, hopefully George will allow me that. So to begin with, let's start with a simple, classical, if you like, example to motivate things. And in classical error correction, what's a standard trick you do? Well, if you have a 0 and 1, and they're going to be exposed to noise, one of the things you can do is build in redundancy to the encoding. So 0, you might encode as a 0, 0, 0. 1, you might encode as a 1, 1, 1. And then we'll think of this as our logical 0 and our logical 1. And so for simplicity, let's suppose that the noise model is, okay, so the noise model is at most one bit flip can occur. Okay, so at most one bit flip can occur. Okay, so what can happen? Well, if we look at 0, for instance, so 0 can, logical 0 can go back to itself. It can go to 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, or 1, 0, 0 with different probabilities built into the noise model. Okay, and so how do you correct this sort of error, for this sort of error? Well, you do a majority vote, right? But practically speaking, what does that really mean? Like, what do you actually do? You're going to look at the output, right? And then based on what you see, you'll do the correction based on that, right? So if you like, you can break it up, the correction process up into two steps, namely, I'll call it a measurement, okay? So I want to, this is going to connect with something that'll come later, but we'll have a measurement and then the actual correction procedure based on that measurement. And so what do you do? Well, if you measure and you see 0, 0, 0, then of course you do nothing. Okay, 0, 0, 1, flip the third bit. 0, 1, 0, flip second bit. And 1, 0, 0, flip the first bit. All right, so very, very simple, but I'm being laborious about this because I'm going to come back to it in a quantum setting. Okay. Right. Okay. So that's sort of a very simple-minded classical example, but already you can see that this standard trick in classical error correction, building in redundancy, doesn't work in the quantum setting. Okay. So in the quantum case, well, you can't even get this trick doesn't even get off the ground, because now we're looking at, instead of bits, we're looking at quantum bits, okay, or qubits. So psi is going to be a mixture of 0 and 1 now. Okay, so where so there's a quantum state associated with a two-level quantum system, right? So alpha, beta, complex numbers that determine a unit vector. Okay, so that's a quantum bit, a good old quantum bit. And what you see very quickly is that you can't do this. In particular, if you try to take an arbitrary qubit and copy it, okay, or build in this sort of redundancy, and so now the product in the quantum case becomes tensor product, Well, what you see is that if you try to do this for an arbitrary qubit, well, you can't. You can't. All right. You can't do this because it's a nonlinear operation, right? And quantum mechanics is a linear theory. So this is not a quantum operation. Okay. So it's because it's non. Linear, and this very simple observation has a grandiose name. It's the fabled no cloning theorem. Okay, in quantum information, and So this is really sort of a teaser. All right, things are really different, and you see that right away in the quantum case. Nevertheless, things are also the same, and I'll come back to this idea a little later. Okay, so what is a quantum operation, right? What is the formalism? So, and in particular, what is the noise that we're trying to deal with in quantum error correction? So, quantum noise models then. And so we're going to have some quantum system. We'll have a Hilbert space associated with some quantum system. And at this point, mainly for experimental reasons, the focus is on finite dimensional space. Okay. So a quantum operation then, is a completely positive trace preserving, map on B of H. Well, here's one of the half truths. So strictly speaking, you should be looking at the density operators, the positive operators with trace equal to 1, but in the trace preserving picture. But finite dimensions we'll just consider B of H, and that's the definition of a generic quantum operation. Okay, and they arise all sorts of different ways in quantum information, quantum computing, all the quantum information science disciplines. Okay, you can say. What do we know about these things in complete generality? Well, of course we know we can regard them as pieces of larger unitaries, right? In the standard way. So there exists some unitary, some CP. A CP map that is implemented by some unitary operator, okay, that acts on the in the quantum information language acts on the system together with as part of a composite system in contact with an external environment, okay, and so this is a if you like what I'm. So this is the characterization of open quantum system dynamics, right? And so you think of this as a closed quantum system. And so there exists this unitary, this unitary CP map, and some fixed density operator on the environment, okay, and I suppose I should mention this. I'll fall into using rows for density matrices, positive trace 1, such that for all rho, the math looks like first taking rho, tensor it with this fixed environment density operator, evolving it by the big unitary. And then throwing away the environment in a physical way, in a trace preserving way, all right? And so the operation there is called the partial trace. Okay, so the trace over the environment. For me, it took a while to get used to this formulation of things because this is sort of the dual, I think, of what you normally see in operator theory in particular. At least the way I learned it through sort of Paulson's book and through Arvidsson's work is sort of the dual of this, namely viewing your maps as compressions of things. And this literally is the dual of that. In other words, you look at Well, I'll explain more precisely what I mean. The Hilbert-Schmidt dual, okay? So I'll get back to that. But this is really the dualized version of Steinspring, okay? So this is really... Steinspring. And so physically all I'm talking about here is just the going back and forth between the Schrodinger picture, this, and the Heisenberg picture, which is the CP unital instead of CP trace preserving. Okay. All right, so... right, what else can we say in complete generality? Well, we can say that these maps have a very nice form. Okay, so these maps have a nice form in the sense that there exists a family of operators. Right, and so this derives from work going way back into the early 70s. Choi and, not together, separately, Choi and Krauss, there exists a family of operators, non-unique operators, EA, non-unique family, on the Hilbert space, such that the map really has this form, the summation of EA, rho, EA dagger, so that's, of course, complete positivity, and the trace preservation condition you can easily check that it's equivalent to this extra constraint. Now, so this is again another half truth I'm gonna tell. In the context of quantum computing, and especially linking with experimental work, we don't have. So in general, you may not have access to the entire set of noise operators. You may only have partial information on these error operators or these noise operators. So mathematically, this is robust, but in sort of an experimental context, there are issues there. Okay, and if I have time, I'll come back to some work in that direction. Okay, so I'll come back to that. But for the moment, assume that we really do have these operators in hand. Okay, along with the noise model. So these. Call these noise operators or error operators. One of the largest class of meaningful, physically meaningful quantum operations, and certainly in the context of this talk, are the probabilistic mixtures of unitaries. In other words, randomized unitary channels. Okay, so take any set of unitary operators. And you can define and a classical probability distribution, and you have a channel, a quantum operation, which you can really think of as the unitary, the error operator UA is applied with probability PA. Okay, so that really is the correct interpretation of this. And actually, well, maybe while I'm here, I'll define some unitaries that are going to come up along the way. So the Pauli operators and their tensor products. Okay, so X is the Pauli bit flip, so represented in the computational basis, the 0-1, so given fixed 0-1 basis corresponding to two classical base states, then Y, 0, negative I, 0, and Z, base flip. Okay, and then the Pauli group, the n qubit Pauli group is just the tensor products of these operators together with the identity thrown in. Okay, so the Pauli group. Sorry, this is getting a little compressed here. The Pauli group is right. So maybe I say I can just sort of do shorthand here. Generated by operators like X tensor identity a bunch of times. So for a fixed n, right? So for a fixed n qubit space, in other words, the tensor product of C2 with itself n times. So it's that all the group generated by all tensor products of X, Y, Z, and the identity. Okay. So this is likely the most important class of unitaries that. That come up in this context. Okay. So, right. So what of quantum error correction then? Oh, I can do this, right? Okay. So In quantum error correction, then, I've told you what the noise looks like. Where are we encoding things? What do the codes look like? Okay, and one of the most general frameworks for quantum error correction encodes quantum bits, quantum information, into subsystems. Okay, so a subsystem, so quantum system B, and this definition applies equally for A, another quantum system, is a subsystem of our given quantum system H, if simply H has a decomposition that looks like this. Okay, so B can be regarded as a tensor factor of a subspace. Okay, of the big system. Okay, and so B is going to be, screw it all that follows, B is going to be the focus of where, B is going to be where we're going to encode, think of our encoded information. So our encoded qubits, okay? And, so we're going to encode it there. Our noise model is going to act on the whole space, and then we have to say what we mean by correction, okay? So the definition in this setting of correction looks like this. So we say B is correctable for E, okay, if there exists another quantum operation. It has to be, right, it has to be a physical map, not just a CP map. It has to be really possible to implement it physically. So a completely positive trace preserving map R, okay, which is going to be the recovery operation, okay, such that for all operators on the A system, that's what I mean by this, and for all operators on the B system, there exists some operator on, and we're going to be focused, so again, in the Schrodinger picture, we're focusing on density operators, so all these are density operators. There exists a tau A such that if I look at what E does to rho A tensor rho B, okay, and then apply the recovery operation, okay, what I want to make sure is that I at least get back that B component, all right? So this is tau A tensor rho B. Okay, in particular, the B system is preserved. Okay, so the codes that arise here, now some computer scientists have picked this up and they've introduced this terminology, which I think is appropriate here. So B is called, such a B is called a subsystem code. Okay. And these have received a fair bit of interest lately, and even all the way to people have used subsystem codes to get significant improvements in the threshold theorem for fault-tolerant quantum computing, okay, which is outside of the scope of this talk, okay, but definitely of interest. Some notable special cases, especially for this talk. So the first case is when the subsystem is really, it's a red herring. You really are looking at a subspace, okay? So in other words, the dimension of A is equal to 1, then in that case, what you really, you know, what this is going to recover is the standard notion of a quantum error correction, the standard quantum error correcting subspace code. So B is a standard quantum error correcting subspace code. And this was the in the sort of early to mid 90s, these were the focus of the investigations of quantum error correction almost entirely. And in particular, if you know this stuff a bit, Gottesman's Daniel Gottesman's stabilizer formalism is the most well-known sort of general scheme to construct codes, and basically it's a way to construct codes for noise models where your noise operators come from a polygroup. Okay. So let me give you an example, one of the most important examples that was discovered in this direction, right, sort of at the time when quantum error correction was just getting off the ground, and that's Shor's, what's now known as Shor's 9-qubit code. Okay, so this is 9 by 9 qubit. This is what I mean by that. It's on, right, C2 tensored with itself 9 times, right? So it's on 2^9 dimensional space. And it's a qubit code. Okay, so there's a logical 0 and a logical 1. The logical 0 looks like this. It's so it's 000 plus 111, and then repeated a couple more times. All right, so normalized. And so to be clear, what I mean here is all the products in sight here are tensor products, right? So this is 111 is 1 tensor, 1 tensor, 1. And all the multiplication here is tensor products. So it really does give you a vector 2^9 dimensional space. And logical 1 is the same thing, just with minuses, okay? All right, and so you can see somehow, even though no cloning theorem says you can't, strictly speaking, you can't copy qubits, somehow you can see that Shor's example sort of cheats the truth somehow. There is somehow there's redundancy built in here with that construction, and that code has some really spectacular properties. So what is the code specifically? I mean, you know, the code which encodes one qubit is the span of those two vectors, and so it does a number of things. One thing it does is corrects any collection of single qubit errors. Okay? In other words, so by a single qubit error, this one doesn't move, right? Okay. So by a single qubit error, I mean an arbitrary element of the poly group that has the identity everywhere, and then at most one of the qubits has an XYZ on it, right? And so you can take any collection of single qubit operators. Actually, it does a lot more than that, okay? But in particular, it does that. And I mentioned this threshold improvement with subsystem codes. I should mention there's this extension of this code to the case of subsystems that is it's called the Bacon-Shor. So Dave Bacon, a computer scientist, discovered a subsystem analog of Shor's theorem, of Shor's code. The Bacon-Shor code is a family of codes that have really led to this improved threshold theorem in fault-tolerant quantum computing. Right, but let me come back then to that picture, that simplistic picture that I started with in the classical case, right, of error correction. And you can get a feel for how error correction works in the quantum case. It's the same sort of intuition, just in a different formalism, right? So the idea here is so we have our code space C, and suppose we have the possibility of nothing happening, all right, and the possibility of some unitary error occurring. And then the possibility of another unitary error occurring, and assume that all three of these subspaces we get are mutually orthogonal, and that's just not a that's not that, that's that's that assumption is actually prototypical. That's really what happens when you have a correctable code after you sort of reformulate the noise operators on the subspace. But right, so in this situation, and this picture links back with the picture I had earlier, right? It's the same sort of idea at this point. What you do now is measure, determine where where you've gone to, and based on that measurement, you perform a correction operation, right? So, and now, by measure, we really do mean measurement, right? A von Neumann projective measurement, namely the one associated with, so if I take P naught as the projection here, P1 projection there, P2 the projection there, and okay, we could, if they don't fill up the whole space, we could complete it with the orthogonal complement. So the measurement there is P naught, P1, P2, and so what do you do? Well, if your detector for P naught clicks when you measure, you do nothing. In other words, the identity operation is applied, operator is applied. If you get P1, it means you're over here, and to get back to C, then you've got to undo U1, so you apply U1 dagger, right? Similarly, P2, you apply U2 dagger. Okay, so I've written correction here, but really the correction, the full correction operation, the CP map you build is really it really is these two together, these two steps together. Okay. All right. So that's a little bit of a tangent. So the special cases. Okay, so the special cases. So the other one, other special case I want to note is the case where you don't have to do any correction. In other words, the noiseless codes. Okay, so this is the case in which, if you like, the identity CP map is good for the correction operation, right? And these are called passive codes, okay? So passive codes, and so the technical names they go by are so in the case that the ancilla of your subsystem, the dimension of A is equal to 1, so it's actually a subspace. The terminology here is decoherence-free subspace. Okay, decoherence-free subspace, and then when dimension of A is greater than 1, it's what's known as a noiseless subsystem. And actually, this is a good example of how what's happening in this field. I mean, you have different terminologies for two terms that are obviously, well, now we know, are really special cases of a more general thing and intimately related. And the reason for this is that these two different notions arose through basically two different camps or groups of researchers, right? So those are the passive codes. And the one that hopefully I'll have a chance to talk about in addition to that is the case, well, I mean, you could ask, what is sort of the simplest case beyond doing no correction? Well, you might have a lot of suggestions there, but probably the most natural one physically is the case where your correction operation is just a single unitary operation, right? So you don't have to, if you like, you don't have to do a measurement. So this is the case of, so when the correction operation is unitary, this is the case of what we're calling now unitarily correctable codes. Okay. All right. So those are the cases I want to focus on. But let me motivate looking at these two cases. What's one of the first things you'd like to do? Right. Okay. So there it is. Notice that. Oh, okay. So the sort of assumption you're going on here is that we have the noise model E, or at least again, sweeping a little under the rug, assuming we have partial information on it, but Actually, okay, so my assumption was we know E, okay? So at the end, I'll come back to a case where you have partial information. But so assuming we have E, you'd like to characterize correction somehow independent of the correction operation, right? Because that correction operation is somehow, it's out there. You don't really know what it is. So you'd like to characterize correction strictly in terms of E and a code, right? And if you like, this amounts to finding a testable condition. And that's one thing we can do in general. Okay, so the theorem in that direction is, and so you can think of this as testable conditions. Okay, and so the subspace case was proved actually now over 10 years ago by Knill and LaFlemme. And now the subsystem case was worked out in works of myself, LaFlemme, Nielsen, and Poulin. Okay, and so what it looks like in the general subsystem case, what it looks like is this. All right. So I'm going to assume that we have some B and E, sort of arbitrary but fixed somehow. B is correctable for E if and only if, two, there exist operators FAB. Oh, yeah, right. So remember, I'm assuming now we have the noise operators, the EAs, okay? There exists FAB on the ancilla A, okay, such that if I compress the operators EA dagger EB to the A tensor B subspace, then what we get is just the identity operator on the B system and these FABs on the other. Okay, so one direction of this is really pretty simple, and one is kind of tricky, so maybe I won't tell you which is which. Right, so they're testable conditions. Okay, so this is nice. This can be helpful, and in particular, these testable conditions actually are what motivated Gottesman's stabilizer formalism. You can use these testable conditions in the case where your error operators are the coming from the poly group. You can use these testable conditions to actually build codes. A large class of error correcting codes. But mathematically, if you look at this, you sort of, or at least I look at this and would think that there's, you know, can we do better in this sense? So notice that this depends on the identification of some code, right? Well, what if you just have the noise model? Can you find the codes for your given noise model? So basic problem, given your noise model E, okay, and for the time being, assume we have its noise operators even, can we find the Bs? Okay. And so in general, I don't think it's possible to do this, so in complete generality, and I expect there's a complexity theoretic argument that would really quantify that statement, okay? But at the least, we know now that we can do this in some special cases, namely these two cases. So, yeah, the answer is yes, at least in special cases. Okay, so first of all, in the passive case, okay? Oh, I'm not using good use of board space. Well, okay. So in the passive case,
So passive quantum error correction. Again, that's the case in which you don't have to do anything.
Well, okay. So you don't have to do anything at the correction stage. Of course, there's encoding and decoding that I'm not talking about at all. But so in the correction stage, you don't have to do anything. And so now we can do this in the sense that you give me an E, and we have now a computational algorithm that'll find the codes. Okay, and okay, so in my mind, it falls out of what I think we can regard as a structure theory now for passive quantum error correction, in particular that comes out of the work of Choi and I, and also Knill now. So I'm not going to go into the details of this, but some of you have seen me talk about this set of things before. But let me just point out, in the unital case, in the unital CP trace preserving case, where it comes from. In the unital case, so if E is unital CP trace preserving, then the fixed point set, which we heard about fixed point sets just previously, so of CP maps. So the fixed point set is actually an algebra in this case, and it's equal to the commutant of the error operators. Okay, and right. So you know, well, write it down. So it's clear that if you have a subspace, at least the operators on a subspace are fixed, and it's clear that's going to be decoherence-free subspace. For a noiseless subsystem, there is this ancilla stuff going on, so there's a little bit to write down there. But the point is that this algebra really will encode all the passive codes for a unital channel, for a unital quantum operation. Okay, and you can go and compute it again, assuming you know the noise operators. Which interestingly, for such quantum operations, the algebra generated by the noise operators is automatically self-adjoint. So that comes out of this. That's built into this as well. The non-unital case is a little more delicate, all right. But there is at the end there is an algorithm there that you can apply to get the codes. Okay, so that's the passive case. And to motivate something that I'll come back to, let me just describe a very simple example. Very simple example of a passive code. So if you have, for instance, if your error model is, noise model is, so with some probability you have nothing happening, with some probability say you have a phase flip on the first qubit. So those are the noise operators, the channel. So the channel looks like, so 1 minus p rho plus p z1 rho z1, and z1 by z1 I mean z tensor I2. Okay, so it's on is happening on four-dimensional space c2 tensor with itself, and okay, and so this is right explicitly this is 1 1 negative 1 negative 1. Okay, and so you can see that, right, the commutant of these guys is, of course, just the commutant of Z1, and of course it's direct sum 2x2 matrices with themselves, okay? And because you have no tensor product here, of course you have a subspace, and so what that really means is you have two decoherence-free subspaces for this this channel, and in particular, the span of the first two basis vectors is a DFS as is the span of the second two. Okay, very simple example. Let me note though, again, connect back with this in a little bit. If your error model was instead some probabilistic mixture of Z1 and Z2, okay, then you get no passive codes here. Okay, since from an algebraic perspective, the commutant of Z1 and Z2 is just the diagonal matrices, the classical matrices, if you like, in the
in the computational basis. Okay, so I'll come back to that shortly. Okay, so the other special case is the case of unitary correction, and in particular, let me motivate it better than that. So we have this good structure theory and an algorithm now that gets us the passive codes. So the natural question to ask is, remember the basic problem I posed over here. So keeping in mind that it's probably unlikely to do this in complete generality, we have a good passive theory. Are there special cases of the active theory in which we can extend effectively this passive theory, right? And the one special case, unitary correction, we can do this. Okay, so the problem then is, or the question is, can we extend the passive theory at least to special cases of active quantum error correction? All right, and so the answer is yes. Yes, we can in at least this one case. So the case of unitarily correctable subsystem codes. Okay, UCS. And so again, this is the case where your correction is a unitary operation. Okay, so what's the point here? Well, we're going to restrict to the unital case, okay? So, and let's just make a simple note that E being unital, CP trace preserving, implies that the Hilbert-Schmidt dual for E is actually the same, right? It's unital CP trace preserving as well. So unital CP trace preserving, in fact, so of course in that case it's an if and only if. And maybe the easiest way to see this is to note that the Hilbert-Schmidt dual gives the noise operators for the Hilbert-Schmidt dual are just the adjoints, the stars of the initial noise operators. Okay, so if the relations are satisfied here, they're satisfied if and only if they're satisfied over here. And so in particular, what that means is that this is a physical map. Okay, so this E dagger is on the table as a possible map that can be implemented by experimentalists, right? And it can be considered as a possible correction operation, right? Which segues into the theorem here is that in the unital case, so one thing we can show then is that in the unital case, and work with Rob Speckens, that so if E is unital, CP trace preserving, then code is unitarily correctable for E, if and only if it is a noiseless subsystem or DFS, so a passive code, all right, for the map composed with its Hilbert-Schmidt dual. Okay. Now this is a channel again. Unital trace preserving, compose those two together, you get unital trace preserving again. So not only is this a physical map, but it's also a unital map, right? And so we can use that commutant theorem to get the passive codes for this channel, right? Its noise operators are going to be, if we have EAs, okay, these are EB dagger EAs, noise operators, and so we can apply here passive theory to get the unitarily correctable codes for E. Okay, so that now answers this problem at least for all unital trace preserving channels. And the question we're looking at is the non-unital case. And things are more difficult there, but so I'm talking with Mandoen about this, but we're pretty sure we can nail it down. The issue there is that E dagger, at least physically, E dagger is not
is no longer a physical map, right? So you have to keep that in mind. So another experimental issue that comes up is, okay, so E dagger, in other words, this also shows here that E dagger can act as the correction operation for these codes, right? But implementing a general CP map is more tricky than implementing a unitary, right, experimentally. And so in particular, you'd like, even though this is a good correction operation, you actually, if there's a unitary that can do it, you'd like that unitary, right? And as you might expect, built into this theorem is a recipe, basically, to go and get unitaries. But still, there are interesting issues that come up, even in simple examples, okay? So let me come back to a very simple example that has turned out to motivate an experiment, or at least plans for an experiment. Okay, so the Z1, oh damn, did I just erase? So Z1, Z2, okay, so Z1, Z2, so our error model saves in probabilistic mixture of Z1, Z2. So we saw this has no passive codes, but you can see, well, if you want to apply the theorem, you can see it has unitarily correctable codes just by looking at the noise operators for E dagger composed with E, in this case, right? Everything's self-adjoint, so it's just the pairwise products of these things. You're going to get the identity twice, and you'll get Z1, Z2 twice. In other words, Z tensor Z, right? So really, the noise operators look like this. And so to compute the passive codes for this one, that amounts to getting the commutant of Z tensor Z, which is -1, -1, -1. Okay, and so you can see immediately that in the commutant you have two single qubit codes, and in particular one of them, let's write down one of them, the span of 0, 0 and 1, 1, okay, the first and fourth basis vector in the computational basis forms a correctable code, and one that you can correct with a unitary. And so what's a unitary that does it, right? Remember I emphasized this importance of getting your hands on a unitary. Well, one unitary that does it is just that one, okay? That'll correct things. And so at this point, okay, so I say to this audience, how much simpler could you get for a unitary, right? That's just about as good as it gets. And so I sort of made this cocky comment to a group of experimentalists, and they sort of snickered, because actually, as it turns out, this is actually quite difficult to implement experimentally, because it's not a tensor product, right? It's not a tensor product of unitaries. It's actually, at least in the computational basis, it's what they would call a two-qubit unitary gate, okay? And it's not a tensor product. And this actually, so this started a conversation with one of the experimentalists in the crowd, and what he forced me to recognize that I obviously should have known is that even though we talk about unitary correction, I mean, ultimately what it really boils down to is partial isometries, right? You're really only trying to reverse things on subspaces. You actually have some freedom on how you build the unitary. For this particular code, for instance, I mean, you need a 1 and a -1 there. Okay, but in the middle here, you can have an arbitrary 2x2 unitary, right? I mean, you can just easily see in the computation that any unitary of that form is gonna correct that code, that particular code. And so in particular, this one, right? And this one, do the job. So both of these are okay, and they're both tensor products. They're both what they would say single qubit gates. Okay, there's only, the only non-trivial stuff going on is on a single qubit. So both these unitaries
correct this this error. And I mean, you know, if you hadn't seen it already, I mean, you just it's easy to see this just writing it down. But so this this actually has motivated an experimental implementation of this scheme, starting with this example and hopefully looking at more general things. So this is I think you could say at the planning stage with so Kevin Resch, a new recently hired experimentalist at the Institute for Quantum Computing, myself to begin with, so I could show you the experimental schematic, but in private, I don't feel comfortable enough, I think, to talk about it publicly at this point. Right. Okay. So I've completely lost track of time and off schedule. Where am I? Am I done, basically? Oh, sorry. Okay. Well, I could always say more, but I won't. Okay, thanks.